Welcome to Neonatology Now, the official podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Here at Neonatology Now, we are shining a light on the real-world experiences of world-renowned experts in perinatal medicine. Together, we will learn from top medical doctors, researchers, and opinion leaders to better understand how we can improve professional neonatal care in Europe and beyond. It's not just about the science. It's about the stories and experiences shaping this critical field of medicine. And now, without further ado, let me introduce you to your host, a seasoned neonatologist and our guide through these fascinating conversations, Professor Mario Rüdiger. Mario, take it away.
Welcome to a new episode of Neonatology Now, the podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Today's topic, cranial ultrasound in newborns. I'm Professor Rüdiger. My guest for today is Dr. Sandra Horsch from Berlin, Germany. Today it's my great pleasure to have Sandra Horsch as a guest. Sandra, welcome to Neonatology Now.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Yeah, so we will have about 45 minutes to talk about cranial ultrasound in neonates. And as usually, before we get into details, I would like to introduce my guest, Sandra Horsch. Sandra, you are actually a real European neonatologist since you have worked in several European countries. Currently, you are based in a large neonatal unit in Berlin at the Helios Klinikum Buch, but actually you went to medical school in Marburg and Essen in Germany, and after medical school, you did not only start your clinical career, but also your research in the field of neonatal neurology at the University of Essen. And for your PhD, you went to the well-known Karolinska Institute in Stockholm for 2 years, I think. And the PhD thesis was about MRI and ultrasonography in extremely preterm infants. And later you have also worked in the Netherlands at the neonatal intensive care unit in Rotterdam. And in 2012, you came back to work in Germany. And you are still very much interested in cranial ultrasound. And you're a founding member of the EURES Brain Group, which is a group of European neonatologists with a special interest in neonatal cranial ultrasound, and that also provides training in neonatal ultrasonography. And furthermore, you're also active in the field of work-life balance and empowering female clinicians and researchers in neonatology. That's a short or long introduction from my side. What have I forgotten that is still important to you?
No, that sounds very complete and very nice. Thank you.
Yeah, but maybe later on we can talk about the topic of work-life balance a bit more. But to learn more about my guest, I always ask for a special anecdote in your professional career. Do you have an episode that you would like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, well, I think probably for all of us, the people that surround us and the people who work with us, they influence most. And I was lucky to have a mentor like Claudia Roll early on, who got me interested into cerebral ultrasound. And as you said, I was then in Stockholm doing my PhD on it. But when I came to Rotterdam in 2007, I was already a consultant. I thought I know quite okay much about cerebral ultrasound. And then I met Paul Govert, you probably would say in English, who is from Belgium and a real expert in cranial ultrasound. The first times I was scanning with him, it was a baby with quite a rough neonatal start. I was standing next to him and he was looking at the images saying, oh, you see here, the central sulcus looks a bit odd and it's interrupted. And, you know, the vena labiae, I can't really see it. And I was like, whoa, okay. This is next level, and as I think many listeners know, you know, that you try then to smile and look smart and pretend you understand everything, and then you rush home and try to read up and try to understand. And I think it is important to have people like Paul, who is really the best person when it comes to ultrasound and imaging, and really understands all the details of the brain. He has a very deep knowledge on anatomy, and he really likes to understand why things are like they are. And it has always inspired me, and I always have tried to live up to his level, and I know I will never reach it. But I think it's good for young people to know that all of us have been through these kind of situations, and you always feel small. But then, I mean, it's on the other hand really great if you have an example like that and you try to live it like he does, and I still do. And I think it's great if you find something you really love, because that keeps you alert and it gives you energy in our difficult field. So, yeah, so he's really the one who gave me the love for the ultrasound.
All right, sounds good. And I think I'm very happy that you are willing to share your knowledge today with our listeners on cranial ultrasound. And let me start with an observation. So when I started my neonatal career, what is almost 30 years ago, bedside ultrasonography became popular. And we started to perform head sonography in every newborn in our intensive care unit. And we're very proud to do it. And so being a bit provocative, I would say that is the same approach as today. What has changed, in your opinion, during the past 30 years?
Oh, well, a whole lot. I mean, a whole new world. I mean, if you think about the images, you know, the old images of Levine, where you hardly see the ventricles and everything, we have now so much better ultrasound machines. We have high resolutions. We can really, especially if you use high frequency linear probes, you can see so much in detail. Actually, the resolution of the high frequency probes is higher than an MRI. So a lot has happened, really a lot. And we can use it in a different way. And thanks to people like Paul, we have understood more what we should look for. But of course, I mean, everything is operator dependent. So that's why we are so keen on training and trying to keep up the excellence in every center.
Mm-hmm. So being more practical now, so what is your suggestion, or what are the recommendation concerning cranial ultrasound in preterm babies which are on the NICU? When should we do it? What should be done?
Well, it's very important that every NICU has a guideline for this. I mean, there are actually quite little national guidelines on this. But of course, it is important to do a risk adaptation to your schedule. So the most immature babies, if we talk about preterm babies, are, of course, of the highest risk for brain damage. And different types of brain damage occur to different time points. So that's why it's important to start in the first week, already on day one, to rule out congenital abnormalities and antenatal injury. And then day three, you should repeat it, because you have to look if IVH has occurred, because that's the most common period, the first 3 days. And then at the end of the week, because sometimes even in the second half of the first week, it can occur. And then usually at 2 weeks, 21 days, 4 weeks, and then every second week. Because in that late period, it's important to look at the white matter, because white matter injury becomes apparent not earlier than 3 to 6 weeks. And that's the problem with our North American colleagues, who have a tendency to say, oh, you only have to image in the beginning and maybe at the end. But then you will lose a whole lot of information and you will miss cystic abnormalities that need time to evolve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important. Concerning the plane, so everybody's using sagittal and cranial plane, coronal plane. And anything you think is very often forgotten?
Yeah, I mean, what we have known when in the years 2000 to 2010, there were a lot of MRI studies done, routinely MRIs in preterm babies. And what we saw there is that actually abnormalities in the fossa posterior, so cerebellar bleeds, were often missed. And by the use of alternative acoustic windows like the mastoid fontanelle or the temporal fontanelle, you can actually get a really nice view on the cerebellum. And even you can see big hemorrhages for sure. Small punctate lesions you will also see with a good linear probe and with some experience, but all really relevant big lesions you will see, and that has improved a lot our quality of imaging. So I would always suggest to add the mastoid view to the routine scanning protocol because it needs some experience. So, of course, in a very preterm baby, 22, 23, 24, 5 weeks, that is very vulnerable and most probably is on CPAP with a CPAP pad on it. You can choose not to do it in the first days, in the first 3 days, maybe, so to keep the examination short. But one time at the end of the first week, I would strongly suggest to look at the mastoid view and then again later on, because the cerebellum develops a lot during the stay, and we have to see if we see any injury there as well.
Mm. So you were just talking about the cerebellar bleeding. Is there any specific time when there's a higher risk for bleeding in the cerebellum?
No, it's the same, more or less. I mean, there's also a journal matrix in surrounding the fourth ventricle. And usually we see the punctate lesions or the big cerebellar lesions also in the first week of life. So that's a classical time point.
So it's a very similar pathophysiology as periventricular bleedings.
Yeah.
Okay. So we mainly have talked about morphology. What is the benefit of Doppler measurements for cranial ultrasound sound?
Well, Doppler is, of course, a great tool to look at perfusion, but of course also to look at abnormalities. In preterm babies, we don't do it routinely in the first week because they actually, if you have a normal ultrasound without any special questions, there's little questions to answer in the first week. It's more important to include cranial Doppler when there is something very abnormal. If you see an echolucency that you don't really understand and you want to understand, is this maybe arachnoid cyst or is that maybe a vascular malformation? And again, there, it needs some training. And we don't only want to look at arteries. I think in the past 10 years, we have gained a lot of knowledge about imaging the veins, imaging the sinuses, which is, of course, important because sinus vein thrombosis can be an important cause of neonatal seizures. And it's one of the few diseases that we have where we need to treat. So it's important that you really can rule out that. And with ultrasound, I think with the modern machines, it's quite easy if you get used to it. The high-end machines, they have microvascular imaging mode that makes it even more easier. But of course, it all needs training and time, but you should only do it on indications. I mean, don't Doppler a baby just for the fun of it.
Mm-hmm. And so treating preterm babies, there has been an interest in being more observative concerning hemodynamics. But everybody knows the blood pressure is not a good tool to measure hemodynamics. Do you see any point in using Doppler sonography for preterm babies to improve the hemodynamic status?
Only in severe conditions, I think.
Okay.
Sometimes, for example, in pulmonary hypertension, you could see actually that there is an impaired backflow. And of course, in PDA for patent ducts, some people look at the perfusion. And if it's extreme, if you have really a diastolic zero flow or a negative flow, okay, that will give you something. But I mean, in the end, it's not reliable in that sense. And I think if you see really bad perfusion in the brain, you probably have noticed it also before.
Okay.
And have seen bad reperfusion.
Susanna, we have talked about the optimal time point of imaging, the optimal targets of imaging. But actually, what do we do with the results of imaging? What are clinical consequences, or how does your picture or your image, what kind of impact has the image on your clinical management?
Well, I think there are a lot of, because that's always what people kind of try to complain about, like, does it change anything? Yeah, of course it changes things. I mean, when we there are different examples which illustrate it. For example, the venous infarction, so what we formerly knew as IVH grade 4, that is an entity that can be very different. So we can have very small infarctions like coded vein infarctions that really don't matter so much for prognosis. Many babies are normal having this. And then there's a classical big terminal vein infarction where you can directly tell the parents and you know yourself, this baby will have hemiplegia. And of course, it is important when you discuss with colleagues in Razor Just, discuss with parents that you have the knowledge, is this a small infarct, is that a large infarct, and where it is. And this might, of course, if you have a baby that already has a large infarction and then it gets a neck or it gets another complication, that might change your clinical management, and parents need to be informed about it. Other really good example why imaging matters is the post-hemorrhagic dilatation, because we have learned from many clinical studies that we should treat post-hemorrhagic dilatation before clinical signs become apparent, because you need to reduce the pressure and maybe also the toxicity of the CSF with all the blood in it before. So that really changes what you do. And I think there, of course, it's not the only thing, but like everything in clinical, it's an important puzzle. And actually, I was thinking about telling another anecdote that I told, which also illustrates. We had one time a baby with HIE in the Netherlands, referred from another hospital. And it was intubated there, it had seizures there, received medication and came to Rotterdam and had flat EEG, didn't react to anything. And when we came, after 2 days, I saw her first together with Paul and he did an ultrasound. The ultrasound was completely normal. And then we thought like, oh, what is this? You know? So then you think like, okay, and Paul was saying like, this baby doesn't have HIE. And everybody, of course, parents and everybody was already talking about bad prognosis. And then it turned out, then we were of course thinking, okay, what does he have? Maybe a severe inborn error of metabolism or something. And it turned out that this baby had excessive high levels of midazolam due to a medication error that happened somewhere in the course. And after the baby managed to metabolize all his midazolam, was perfectly fine. So you see, you know, of course, it's not, you always need many puzzles to understand what the baby has. You need your neurophysiology, you need your clinical assessment, you need to talk what happened. But imaging also has to fall into place and might help you to understand what's going on with the patient.
Okay, your story is a very good segue to the next question, because we already have talked about preterm babies. Let's talk about more about term babies, and especially in HIE. What is the role of ultrasound, cranial ultrasound in HIE patients?
Well, I think, first of all, our standard treatment is, of course, hypothermia for moderate to severe HIE. And before you start, hypothermia should rule out, like, in this baby, well, this baby we cooled until we found out, but you should find out that there is nothing, that the baby maybe actually have something else and wouldn't profit from hypothermia. So you need to rule out that there is inborn congenital abnormality of the brain, and you have to rule out that there is an unusual big bleeding. So that's why you need it in the first place. And then it's, like I said, it's important to understand the cause of a disease. So I really like the sequential imaging in HIE to see when the edema comes and how the edema resolves. And then usually at day 2 to 3, you will see if it is severe hyperagogenicity in the thalami and in the striatum. And that even before you go to the MRI will help you how you already talk to parents and how worried you are or not worried you are. I mean, if you have a completely normal ultrasound on day 2 and 3, of course, you can spread a bit more optimism already then and don't have to, of course, you will tell the parents we will do the MRI, but still you can say, okay, we have a pretty okay EEG. The ultrasound looks normal until now. We are quite positive. Or on the other hand, if you have very abnormal MRI ultrasound, you can already start preparing them for bad news.
But you would not exclude HIE by ultrasonography, by a normal ultrasonography?
No, but I mean, if you don't have any edema and you don't have like this baby with the Miroslav intoxication, I mean, it all has to fall into places. But of course, you can have HIE without overt lesions. I mean, that's why we do hypothermia, to prevent lesions. You can have encephalopathy and have a pretty good outcome without overt lesions.
Okay. And what other indications do you see for cranial ultrasound in term babies?
Well, it's I think, especially important in those babies that come to us with seizures in the first days, because these babies usually come at night, and then ultrasound is our first imaging tool, and we have to rule out the severe hemorrhage, and we have to rule out sinus vein thrombosis, because both probably needs intervention. The one might need surgical intervention, and the thrombosis might need anticoagulation. And also stroke, but of course, stroke is difficult to see very early on in the course. On the other hand, the babies usually often are transferred from our other hospitals, so you actually see them already maybe 12, 24 hours after the stroke has occurred, and then you might already see something in the ultrasound, hyperechogenicities.
Okay. But you don't see an indication to perform cranial ultrasound in every term-born baby without any symptoms?
A normal baby, no. A normal baby should be a normal baby. I mean, there is no... I know that some units perform ultrasound after assisted vaginal delivery, being afraid that something might happen to the brain there. And I think that doesn't really help anyone, because actually, even after a normal vaginal birth, small hemorrhages below 1 centimeter are quite common. And so small epidurals, sometimes bit of subarachnoid bleed, and you will get a lot of concern for a quite maybe physiologic finding. And if a baby has a problem, it will show it to you. So, I mean, I think you should only scan those if you have any hint of a clinical course, or maybe, of course, nowadays many babies are scanned prenatally. And then sometimes, of course, we have to.
Yeah, that's a good point. So just perform cranial ultrasound if you have a clinical indication. Because, as you already said, you sometimes find some minor results, and it's always difficult to interpret, like calcifications, perivascular calcifications in the term-born infant, or some minor bleeding. Is there any need, if you find this non-significant finding, or you have these non-significant findings, to recheck it again, or what do you tell the parents?
Well, if we see vasculopathy of the thalamostriate vessels or gammonolytic cyst, we usually perform one time CMV. You can do it in the urine or in the saliva very easily, because that, of course, you have to rule out as one course of these minor observations like vasculopathy and gammonolytic cyst. But otherwise, and then you don't have to look ever again. I mean, if the CMV is out, then, I can't really remember one baby that actually had CMV, but we still don't do it. But this minor bleeds, of course, could be as a birth trauma, is actually quite uncommon. What is more common is actually that you see hyperechogenicity in the germinal matrix as a normal finding, which doesn't need any control. And I think we usually, if we find something like that. CMV is the only thing that we do to rule that out, and then we don't control.
Hmm. So when you compare ultrasonography with MRI or other imaging techniques, so what is the role of MRI nowadays if you have such nice devices for performing ultrasonography?
Well, for stroke, I think until now, it's still MRI because it's difficult in the early course and it's difficult to see really the network injury. So for a stroke, MRI is definitely still the gold standard. Although there's a very exciting new, for neonates new, it's a more quite used technique in adults, is the contrast enhanced ultrasound. I don't know if you have seen these amazing pictures when you insert these babies' little bubbles, and then you can see how these bubbles reach the brain, and you can see how the perfusion of the brain. And if there's a stroke, you will see the regions where the perfusion is missing, and you could have then really a bedside detection of a stroke. This is still in a research world, or still, because there's not so many safety trials yet for newborns. But if that comes, I can see, I probably would still do an MRI in the later course. But of course, it would be perfect at a Friday night just to be able, with a short injection of this contrast agent, to know what's going on. Otherwise, MRI, you will need also in sinus vein thrombosis, although you will detect the thrombosis itself pretty well with the ultrasound. But of course, what you're mostly afraid of in sinus vein thrombosis is not the thrombosis itself, but the consecutive injury that you get in the white matter, maybe in the bleed, in the basal ganglia. And that's, especially for the white matter, you will see much better in the MRI. But you don't need to do it at the same day. I mean, you can diagnose it, you can treat it, and then you do the MRI whenever you get it.
Mm-hmm. So you were already talking about the contrast ultrasonography. Any other new developments on the horizon?
Well, there is quite actually for a few years, this ultrafast ultrasound. Olivier Beau in Paris, together with Michael Tonté, they have done great work on it. This is a new technique where they use frame rates that are 100 times faster than the usual frame rates. And with a single ultrasound beam, they can produce an image, which makes ultrasound so fast that you actually can see a neurovascular coupling. So the same principle as you have in fMRI, that activation of neurons is always correlated to a vascular response. So the bolt signal is there also a vascular response that we see in functional MRI. And that's the same with the ultrafast ultrasound, that we see a vascular response to a neuronal activation. So we actually can visualize when a seizure is coming. You can see how the neurons will fire and the vascular response to it. So it's really exciting, but it's not something I can see in the clinics right now. You need an extra device for it. It's quite expensive. The probe has to be fixed to the head. So there are quite some challenges to it. And maybe I always get a bit skeptical if it's already around for some years and doesn't progress to more.
Sometimes that happens. So it sounds very promising, but you have to realize after 10 years, there's no progress like NIRS or other devices. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, sometimes the technical and the financial, I mean, it's difficult. But that's actually for the contrast enhanced ultrasound, if the safety is proven, I think it will make a fast progress to clinics.
Okay. So if you look at the obstetrical ultrasonography, there is very popular nowadays to have 3D ultrasonography. Why is there no progress in neonates?
Yeah, that's really, Exactly, same story, right? When it came, we thought, okay, yeah, next ultrasound device will have a 3D. And actually, there are some people who are doing great work. I mean, there's Isabel Belavente in Cadiz in Spain who's doing great work on it, and also some people in Madrid. But I don't know. It doesn't change. I mean, it's also the acquisition time. You have to do it. It needs a lot of training, and the benefit maybe is not that big as expected. And I mean, if we want to be provocative, which we like to be, I mean, also in gynecology, I mean, it's often you have the, I mean, of course, there's very useful applications for this, I guess, for heart diseases and so, but mm-hmm. mainly it's to make nice pictures for parents, at least in Germany, I would say, and to see, like, oh, this is the nose of the father and this is the nose of mother. So, I mean, of course, they're very important applications to diagnose things, and probably because a fetus is much harder to reach, you need it more to get really an idea of what you see. I think it's very helpful. We can turn the baby and choose the plane as we want, as the baby is outside. I think, you know, we can can get a better regional idea without having 3D. But I mean, no offense to the people who love it. I think it's good, but I doubt it will come.
Okay. So if we meet again in 10 years later and you have the chance to choose or you to wish how ultrasonography should look like in 10 years, what is your idea? What will it be?
Well, would be that everybody would really use it with the same enthusiasm as some people that I know, because it really depends on how much love you put into it and knowledge. Mm. Course, that you will get out. And if you train it a lot, if you train your people good, then you will get a lot out of it. And in 10 years, you will have even higher resolutions, even more application values, and it will give you a lot of information. I don't think it will replace MRI. Maybe the other way around, MRI will make the way to the bedside. We don't know. Maybe that could be also happening. But again, of course, it's always a competition between the MRI people and the ultrasound people. But in the end, I mean, these are complementary imaging methods you should use. You shouldn't fight each other, but you should see what is indicated or what is helpful in one or the other patient. And hopefully the contrast enhanced will be then clinical routine. And hopefully even more, we will have therapies to cure diseases, because that's until now a bit limited, the options that we have to cure neurological diseases. So we hope for the stem cells to come.
Okay. That's a different topic. Sandra, you're actually already working to achieve the goal that clinicians be getting better or become better in the future. Let's talk a bit about the Euros Brain group you are working with.
Yeah, that's a group that was founded in 2016 by Paul Robert that I mentioned, and his fellow peers in his age, Luca Ramenghi, Adelina Pellesa, also people who have worked a lot in neonatal neurology and imaging. And the idea was really to guarantee training on an expert level, because in many countries we have taken over the ultrasound from the radiologist and we haven't really structurized our training to keep up the quality. So the idea was that we provide training for experts for every big center, and then these experts should spread this high knowledge to their colleagues. In 2022, after Corona also, we started to do basic courses, online courses, because we understood that it's not about only the experts. It's also a lot, a high need for young residents that they can just have. And they really like the online version of it. I mean, it's easy to connect. It's usually a Saturday morning and you get a nice overview over the possibilities of ultrasound and get hopefully inspired. We use this group not only for teaching, we write paper together about topics in ultrasound, and we try to promote research in the field. And even more about this, we send each other cases and ask each other's opinion, and we keep on learning from each other every time. And I think that's, if you're in the group, the highest value of it. And yeah, you can visit us at the ESPR website. We are a subgroup of the ESPR, and our website is located there. And yeah, there are courses. They will be announced there. Unfortunately, the expert courses, it's only few students, so we have a long list. But yeah, I think it's a great group, and all of us are very open. If you have questions or you have a patient and you want to have an opinion, I mean, you can contact one of us, and I guess nearly all of us will answer quite fast.
Sandra, I'm always impressed how enthusiastic you are about this topic and to work in this group. And so I think many listeners will contact you and will have some, will join the group, I think. But a different topic you are enthusiastic about is how to empower female researchers, female clinicians, how to make it possible to combine clinical work, research work, and family life. And do you have any aspects you want to mention at the end of our podcast on that topic?
Well, of course, it's a big topic. And I didn't get to this topic because I thought, like, this is a great topic. I went to this topic because I left Germany in 2004 to Sweden and lived in Sweden. And then I was shortly back in Germany. And then I went to Rotterdam, to the Netherlands, and then I came back to Germany. And when I came back to Germany, I really felt, wow, what is happening with our country? Why are we behind other countries when it comes to equity? And that's why I wanted to understand why it's still like that. I mean, of course, now the Dutch listener and the Swedish listener will say, oh, even in our countries, it's not perfect. Of course, it's not perfect. They also have salary gaps, for example, but they have more likelihood to advance in their career as well as their male colleagues. In Germany, we still have very few female head of neonatology, although 80% of women starting medicine and getting into pediatrics are women. So yeah, so I just feel like for the coming years or the last 15 years I will work, I really want to try to help young women to understand that they can do whatever they want to do. Because in my career, quite a few times someone would approach me and say, like, oh, why don't you do pediatric radiology? It would be so much nicer with your small children, you know. And I of course, you could, maybe, I guess it was well meant, but it's offending still. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of small offending moments that you experience, and you always think it doesn't do anything to you, but it does. Because sometimes, you know, parents in Germany will approach you and say, like, when does the doctor come? Because you're a young woman, female doctor, and they think you're a nurse. All these small things may insult you and may change. And I really want to change the attitude of some young women who always excuse themselves. They always like, oh, I'm not good enough, I'm not this, you know. I think it will be good to empower them and show them that, well, this is 2025, you know, you can do whatever you want to, whatever your heart goes for, go for it. Mm. Because this is essential. I mean, you and me, no, we couldn't do the work that we do with all the night shifts and weekends if we wouldn't love it so much. So that's what it comes. If you love something, I mean, you will do it. And we need to make our society and our hospitals in a way that this doesn't exclude having a family. Hmm. Because so, we need babies of smart women.
Yeah, that's important.
Women in the hospital, both.
Yeah. So at the end of our talk, do you have any specific recommendations for students who are at the beginning of their career?
Well, search for a mentor, search for someone you look up to, and try try to find solutions. Of course, you have to make choices in life. You can't do everything at the same time, but you can achieve what you want to achieve and try to find people who think alike and will help you. Of course, it's tough without a mentor. It's always good to have some. I was always very lucky having people helping me. I guess you also have been. You need those. So try to find out and spread enthusiasm. I think if you're really enthusiastic about what you want, you will find people helping you find your way.
That's a very final, very, very nice final word, Sandra. Thank you very much for the talk.
Thank you as well.
That was it again. Neonatology Now, the podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Mario Rüdiger on the mic, and my guest for today was Sandra Horsch. If you do have any questions or comments, do not hesitate to contact us. Thank you for listening.